Greetings and welcome to the Journal of Southern Religion podcast. My name is Art Remillard. I'm the book review editor for the JSR, and I teach at St. Francis University in Loretto, Pennsylvania. It's fair to say that Michael Sean Winters is Catholic to the core. He writes for the National Catholic Reporter, and he says that his blog, Distinctly Catholic, quote, examines politics, religion, and the estuary where the two meet, all from a distinctively Catholic point of view. Additionally, his 2008 book, Left at the Altar, traces the historical relationship of Catholics and Democrats from the New Deal to the present. Yet this distinctively Catholic author pivoted in an evangelical direction with his new book, God's Right Hand, How Jerry Falwell Made God a Republican and Baptized the American Right, published by Harper One in 2012. Here today to discuss his book is Michael Sean Winters. Michael Sean, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you, Art.
First, let's start with the obvious question. Why a book on Jerry Falwell, especially from a distinctly Catholic author such as yourself?
Well, in the event, it was suggested to me by Leon Wieseltier, the literary editor of the New Republic. And he thought precisely because of my first book, having examined the relationship of Democrats and Catholics, this was kind of a natural to look at the other side and examine the relationship of Republicans and evangelicals. And in the event, there had not been a real serious biography of Jerry Falwell since 1984. And so it seemed a natural way to go. It did mean that I felt like I was waking up inside a photographic negative for 4 years because the issues were all familiar, but everything was reversed from where I was accustomed to finding it in the first book.
Right. Well, okay, let's start in on his biography then. What did you find interesting or unique about his early years as a pastor? What kind of person was he then? What were his concerns?
Well, it's important to remember, you know, he converted, he was not raised in a Christian home. His father was an agnostic and a heavy drinker and a bootlegger and an entrepreneur. And so when Jerry converted, he was a student at college in Lynchburg. He went whole hog, and that was part of the dynamic for the rest of his life is, you know, we from the poker games, we now know all in. He was always all in. And so when he returned from seminary in Missouri, he went back to Lynchburg. He was asked to found a parish, which they named Thomas Road Baptist Church. It was a dissident group from another Baptist church. They bought an old bottling plant that had been a soda bottling plant and scrubbed the soda syrup off the floor and started worship. What was interesting is he brought from his mother's side of his family this deep religious faith. But also from his father's side, he had this very intense entrepreneurial spirit. So he put up a map of Lynchburg on the wall, and in the center he put a pin marking the church and concentric circles. And the immediate neighborhood was called Jerusalem, and beyond that, Judea. And this was how he approached it. He was going to start from the center and evangelize, and he tried to knock on 100 doors every weekday. He would take copious notes. Remembering what church the people attended, if they did attend a church, was there a radio in the house, did they have children, these sorts of things. He would then follow up with a personalized letter, and then a member of the parish would follow up on a subsequent visit. So it was this kind of saturation evangelization. He called it the 1-2-3 punch, and later in life would compare his efforts to Eisenhower planning the D-Day invasion. So he was very entrepreneurial from the very beginning, deeply rooted in this fundamentalist faith that he had been converted to. And those two twin aspects, the kind of certainty of fundamentalism with this entrepreneurial sensibility, would really characterize his religious empire for the rest of his life and eventually his politics.
He's really kind of setting a framework for the modern megachurch then.
Absolutely. And he would... you know, in the book, I compare the megachurch to something he never made the comparison. It really resembles the kind of late 19th, early 20th century urban ethnic Catholic parish in that, you know, his kids got school age. He started a school and then he expanded it to a high school, eventually to a university. It's now the largest evangelical university in the world. He started a ministry for alcoholics, largely because of his experience with his dad. He started a home for women who did not want to have abortions, but had no economic means to carry the child to term. Set up an adoption agency. Had not a homeless shelter, but a kind of co-op where the poor could come and get discounted prices for food and clothing and things like this. It really was this social network that he built as a part of his church. And so I think you're right. It really was kind of a proto mega church before we became familiar with the term.
Okay, well then let's turn now to his political activism, because he certainly makes a turn. We think of 1980 as being this sort of definitive year that he comes to rise, and then we get the moral majority. Tell us about how this sort of political juggernaut of Falwell and the moral majority came to be and how it changed and matured over time.
Well, you know, he was raised in a tradition that believed in the spirituality of the church, and this was a doctrine that was really highlighted in fundamentalism in contrast to the social justice and the social gospel movement at the beginning part of the 20th century. He did not believe that social justice and even moral reformation was a proper job for a minister, because he felt, you know, obviously this gets to classic Protestant notions about the action of grace. And he was also deeply afraid of yoking himself with non-believers, and a non-believer would have been anyone who was not a fundamentalist Christian. So this severely limited his political activity. He gave a famous 1965 sermon condemning Dr. Martin Luther King for political activism. But that began to change in the 70s, and there was a congeries of issues. Certainly, I think one of the precipitating factors was Roe v. Wade, in the sense that the Supreme Court, having earlier eliminated prayer from the public schools, now was stepping into an area where there was real no means for the church to defend themselves from that. They could set up a parish school, as he did, to make sure prayer was a part of the educational environment. But the Roe v. Wade decision certainly made him aware that the ambient culture was not something that evangelicals could ever count on anymore. They could withdraw themselves from that ambient culture was now, through the power of the state, was going to infringe even on their ethics and their values within the community. And this deeply disturbed him, but he didn't really know where to go with it. And I think the two seminal influences on him to get him over this idea that he should not be involved in politics, one was Francis Schaeffer, who developed the theory of co-belligerency and argued from scripture that it was fine for believers to be yoked with non-believers, and cited, for instance, Simon the Cyrene helping Jesus carry his cross. The king of Persia actually bringing the Jews back to Jerusalem. And Falwell adopted this, but he was still leery, and he was worried that if he got too politically involved, the people in the pews would rebel. And so a group of Republican operatives, Howard Phillips and Weyrich and people like that, they went to meet with him. And they said, they went armed with a poll. And the poll indicated that the people in the pews, in fact, were chomping at the bit to get politically involved. And so in 1979, he formed the Moral Majority and started organizing even fundamentalists. He had a vast network through the Fundamentalist Church of other churches where he had preached and helped out, and through seminaries and things like that. Excuse me. He was able to tap into that and start registering and educating and motivating fundamentalist voters to go to the polls. This coincided with, you know, the candidacy of Ronald Reagan, who was a somewhat unlikely champion of evangelical values. He was the first divorced president. He had signed a very liberal abortion law when he was governor of California, but he had repented of that. And he famously went to Dallas during the 1980 campaign to a meeting of evangelicals and said, you know, you can't endorse me, but I endorse you. Additionally, I think Reagan kind of lived out that notion of American exceptionalism that the evangelical church had kind of backed into in the 50s, 60s, and 70s in opposition to communism. And so this was another part of the Reagan political creed, that Falwell was very adept at glomming onto. And then the third part of that was the rise of the of gay rights movements in the 70s, which he had opposed before forming the Moral Majority. And then the fourth and last, I would say, was a very fundamentalist concern with the future of Israel. And it's kind of ironic that Falwell and even today's Republicans are very critical of European socialists and use that as a kind of template for everything they wish to avoid. But they celebrate Israel, which, of course, was founded in 1948 by European socialists. But Falwell's reasons for supporting Israel were biblical, not so much geostrategic. And interestingly, once Reagan won, the first break that Falwell had with the Reagan administration was over the issue of selling AWACS to the Saudi Arabia. And the Israeli government opposed this. And it was the first time Falwell distanced himself from Reagan.
There's two things that you said in there that I kind of want to pick up on. And first is, and you make this case later, that the size and political potency of the fundamentalist population was such that they were inevitably going to be pulled into the public sphere eventually. But it just so happened that Falwell was this person. And I'm wondering why you think Falwell was that person who pulled this huge voting block, effectively, into the political process.
A couple of reasons. I think, first of all, he was tireless. You know, organizing a mass movement takes a lot of energy. It requires not just a network of people with whom you're familiar, but people with whom you've taken the time to stay in touch. And this was before the internet and email, and phone calls were expensive. There was no Skype. So this was a time when, he would write notes to people and just, you know, stay up late at night maintaining those contacts. Secondly, he was insanely media savvy. One of the things he did when he first started his church, he approached a local radio station and asked for time. And he thought he'd have to pay for it, but the owner of the radio station was so enthusiastic, he actually gave him some free time every morning as soon as the sun rose. And then within a year, he also had a weekly TV show that he did. So he really was sensitive to the power of media. And, you know, back in the 50s, when he started his church, there was a novelty. So on the radio show, he would say, you know, this is the neighborhood where I'm going to be knocking on doors. And then when he actually got around to knocking on the doors later in the day, people would say, oh, my God, I heard you on the radio today. And this was still something quite novel for people. There were no blogs. There was no medium for which everyone could find their own voice. And so he developed that for, you know, over 20 years before he started the Moral Majority. But I would say his combination of, you know, he had a photographic memory, which obviously helps one in discussions and debate. He had an enormous capacity for friendship, so he very rarely went for a low blow when he was doing a media appearance. And combine that with the kind of certainty that he brought about the issues that he cared about, it made him a perfect guest for Nightline, for the Phil Donahue show. He was the most frequent guest on the Phil Donahue show. And he was a great guest. He was, you know, clearly spoken, had a knack for putting his finger on the key issue. And yet there was a lightness. He was funny. He didn't demonize in that kind of a venue. He would not demonize a Ted Kennedy or a pornographers like Larry Flint, both of whom I mentioned, because he ended up becoming good friends with them. Everything about him personally really made him ideal to be the one who was going to galvanize this previously segregated part of the electorate and bring them into mainstream politics.
Okay, this leads to the second part of what I was going to ask. And when you talk about galvanizing this crew, you talk about how Falwell baptized not just a kind of social policy, but also conservative economic and foreign policy. So can you talk about how he managed to pull all of those parts together into a coherent message and make it make sense with so many people?
I don't know that I would ever say it was coherent. I would say that he had biblical citations for every position he took. But some of them, in kind of a classic evangelical fashion, There's a heavy reliance on the Hebrew scriptures and on the Pauline epistles, not so much on, say, the 25th chapter of Matthew, which, you know, counsels us to feed the hungry and care for the poor and the stranger. So I wouldn't say it was coherent. What I would say is his you know, moral commitments, the social agenda on abortion, gay rights and all that, flowed quite naturally from, you know, the typical sermon fare in the evangelical church. His interest and his willingness to back conservative economics stemmed from anti-communism and this concern about encroaching socialism. And he sometimes went really wacky on that. He attacked the Prime Minister of Canada, Pierre Trudeau, as the, you know, a horrible socialist. And, you know, Pierre Trudeau, I mean, socialism in Canada was not Marx. So he sometimes was incapable of drawing, you know, important distinctions. But he, you know, really was, once he got politically involved, a very loyal foot soldier in the Republican Party. For example, Reagan, once he enters office, went to Falwell and other evangelicals and said, look, the country is in an economic crisis. I have to lead with the economic agenda, and we're going to get around to abortion and school prayer and things like that later. He totally went along with that. Falwell completely endorsed Reagan putting economics first, went on Face the Nation to say so. He really had a sense for understanding how politics went. And once he signed on with Reagan, with whom he developed a, you know, a certain camaraderie, he understood the limits, and very rarely would he distance himself from the administration. And again, I think the anti-communism, in a very superficial way, made evangelicals susceptible to kind of what was then early, you know, Reaganomics as we know it. I suspect he would have a little bit more difficulty today with a kind of libertarian gospel, just because of its roots in, you know, profoundly anti-Christian thinkers like Hayek and von Mises and Ayn Rand. But who knows? I mean, he might have, you know, found a way to baptize them too.
Well, you kind of indicate that at the end, that this sort of lays the groundwork for Tea Party, right?
I do. I think not so much in the actual content of the inspiration, but in the certainty, the either or, the us them, the kind of Manichaean worldview of the Tea Party. You know, this was Falwell's bread and butter. And if it sometimes meant he used language, anti-gay language, for instance, that he was personally uncomfortable with, he had some gay friends, they would call him out on this. And he said, look, my fundraisers tell me that, you know, that this works. That's not really a very good moral excuse. So my sense that he laid the groundwork for the Tea Party is more that you know, we view the Falwell influence primarily, I think, on the Republican Party today, in that it is a pro-life party and things like that. But I would argue that you take someone like Grover Norquist, who I don't know that Grover Norquist can spell abortion, but he has that certainty, that kind of fundamentalist mindset that he brings to the issue of taxes, that is very much this Falwellian spirit, this idea that there's not just a difference of opinions on these issues, but there's an orthodoxy. And so if you disagree with me, you're not just wrong, you're not just coming from a different point of view, you are a heretic. You know, you must be destroyed. This is the flavor of political involvement and political rhetoric that Falwell brought, and it now spans not just issues like abortion, but economic issues and tax policy, where it's not exactly a very neat fit with things like the 25th chapter of Matthew.
Well, this brings about an interesting paradox, this idea of certainty and the kind of us against them, because I'm looking at the blurbs on your book, and I see George Stephanopoulos, I see E.J. Dionne, and I see Larry Flint. And you explain that Flint and Falwell actually had an interesting relationship and a lot in common. So this person who was known as being rather divisive also had some curious friendships. Could you tell us about that?
Well, he met Larry Flint in court. Flint had done a really vulgar parody of Falwell in Hustler magazine, and Falwell sued him. And the first case was heard in district court in Roanoke. And then it went to the circuit court in Richmond, and finally all the way to the Supreme Court. And over time, they developed a kind of dog and pony show where they would go to college campuses and debate the issues involving the First Amendment and versus pornography rights. And they found out that they actually enjoyed each other's company. They were both larger than life figures. They were both absolutely convinced of the veracity of their worldview. They both had private planes. And I believe it was one of the times when the friendship got cemented is one of them said to the other, you know, it's ridiculous for us to always be flying both of our planes. Let's try to, you know, ride with each other when we can and save money. And after that, every time Jerry Falwell went to Los Angeles, he would always visit Larry Flint. And when Falwell died in 2007, Larry Flint wrote this very moving tribute in the LA Times about his friend Jerry Falwell, and that they they disagreed about everything, but they had developed this friendship. And it was not just, you know, that they got together to talk about kids and baseball and things like this. One instance, Larry Flint called Falwell, and Falwell had said some derogatory remarks about Ellen DeGeneres. And Falwell said, you know, I mean, Flint called Falwell and said, you know, that's not called for. And you really crossed a line there. So it was fascinating. That was the kind of thing I learned about Jerry Falwell when I was doing the research for the book that I had no idea about.
Well, let's follow up on this thing about Falwell and his relationships. What was his relationships with Catholics? And conversely, what are Catholic relationships with Falwell? And I guess I'm thinking about also the lasting mark on Catholic political views, especially among conservative Catholics.
Well, he was quite somewhat surprised to learn that within a couple years of forming the Moral Majority, a third of the membership were Catholics. And I think they, again, for some similar reasons, the absence of prayer in the schools had not been a Catholic concern, because, of course, those had been Protestant prayers. We were actually glad to see them go. The abortion issue. And a sense that there was a rising secularism that was taking over the courts and increasingly certain types of legislation made certain conservative Catholics susceptible to the Moral Majority appeal. On the other hand, the Evangelical Church, or better to say the Fundamentalist Church, for a variety of reasons, lacked the kind of intellectual architecture for political engagement. And so you had figures like Richard John Newhouse, who was a prominent convert to Catholicism, who had some serious intellectual chops, who was able to help evangelicals and fundamentalists enunciate their positions and with a certain degree of sophistication. And so, for instance, you have, I believe it was in 1994, Falwell was not a mover in it, but he was supportive of it. The group Catholics and Evangelicals Together was formed. And it was precisely this idea that the moral fabric of America was crumbling and it needed to be restored, and that all believers needed to kind of come together to work on that. And I do think the Moral Majority laid the groundwork for that by getting Catholics and fundamentalists working together in the political trenches. And what developed naturally was an evangelical reliance on conservative Catholics for the intellectual heft that they could bring, and a conservative Catholic reliance on evangelicals for the power that they had at the voting booth. And so a marriage was born that is with us to this day.
I want to kind of skip ahead and think about life since Falwell. And I, for some reason, I have in my head the image of Rich Cizik. You know, Rich Cizik being a prominent evangelical, but somebody who has been advocating creation care. And that's been a kind of divisive issue, I think, within the evangelical community and probably within many communities of faith. Do you think that the two sides of that argument are a result of Falwell, who obviously didn't have a whole lot of concern for environmental issues?
Well, I think Cizik certainly represents the side of the evangelical community that got turned off by some of Falwell's bluster, that was nervous about being too closely aligned with a particular partisan agenda or with a particular party in its leadership. So Cizik comes from that almost to a degree, you know, not from the earlier tradition that Baptists don't get involved in politics, but from this somewhat sizable percentage of evangelicals who are a little resistant to the conservative political platform. You know, we tend to think of evangelicals and fundamentalists as always right-wing conservatives. There's always, you know, a Democrat usually gets 25 to 30% of the evangelical vote in most elections. So there has always been a minority voice. You're right, Falwell certainly did not engage in environmental issues and probably would have sided with today's Republican Party that, you know, big government is almost never the answer. Big government threatens liberties. I don't think he would be joining Cizik in arguing for creation care.
Well, then just to kind of like turn this around. So, you say that Falwell was able to channel this sort of fundamentalist, this large fundamentalist group into politics. Do you think it's possible now with the rise of the nuns and the people who were turned off by the kind of Falwell religious politics, do you think it's possible for somebody now to come along and capture that sentiment? Or is that just not as concrete a group as, say, the fundamentalist bloc was in 1980 when Jerry Falwell came around?
Yeah, my hunch is that the religious left is always going to be a fairly small minority within the left, and that that's increasing. And in a sense, Falwell's career laid the groundwork for some of that. And let me explain what I mean. The moral majority was in existence for 10 years, from 79 to 89. And it was, I think, the 93, maybe 92, but I think it was 93, the Pew survey, for the first time, when asking people to self-identify their religion, a substantial percentage started answering that they had none, that they were not religiously affiliated. And it's, you know, it's hard to draw lines of causality. But insofar as Falwell succeeded in becoming the face of Christianity in the culture, and it was such a fierce and unrelenting conservative face, I think it turned off some people. Some people, I think, just stopped going to church. Others, like Cizik and some others, said, well, we want to be politically engaged, but we want to be more even-handed. Then you have the rise of people like Rick Warren and other evangelical pastors who really don't get very heavily involved in politics at all. So certainly no one has replaced Falwell. And no organization really successfully replaced the moral majority. The Christian Coalition was formed in 89 when the moral majority shut down, but it never had the kind of influence, success rather, that the moral majority had. In the 10 years that Falwell ran the moral majority, the Republicans, you know, won three elections in a row, and they lost the next three in a row. If you count 2000 as a loss because Gore got more votes than the other guy. So I think no one has filled the stage the way Falwell did. I also think a movement once started does tend to, you know, subdivide into important groups, and it is hard to ever be that kind of founding father again. I mean, you know, we look to George Washington in a way that we don't to other presidents, and it's not because he was the brightest bulb of the lot, but because he was the first and received a certain loyalty because he was the first. And then once he left the scene, things descend into parties and divisions. So I think something like that is what happened in the fundamentalist community. But I don't think that the religious left will ever have the influence on the left that the religious right has had on the modern, you know, Republican Party.
Well, let's put a bow on this and tell us, what do you hope readers are going to take away from this book, big picture?
Well, let me say what I'm hearing from readers. I think they were, like me, surprised to find out that he developed friendships with Ted Kennedy and Larry Flint. I hope they will see, you know, the kind of continuities in history that he did lay the groundwork for, you know, a lot of what we see about today's political divisions. I hope they'll come away recognizing that this was a man of enormous talent and gifts. And whatever you think about him, you know, compared to some of the other pastors that the evangelical church have produced, he was never a hypocrite. He was not an Elmer Gantry. He was not stealing money. He was not cheating on his wife. He really was the real deal. And obviously, as a kind of liberal Democrat and Catholic, I have enormous political and religious differences with him. But he does warrant a certain type of respect. That said, he was also capable of real moral blindness. He had been a segregationist. He flipped. He repented of his segregationism. But he never really examined how people professing Christ had been able to adopt segregation. He would recognize, the moral enormity that was perpetrated on blacks, but he never recognized the moral enormity that was perpetrated on whites, that they had been collaborators in this evil system and that it really warranted some serious attention. He really did traffic in horrible anti-gay tropes. And this was at a time when AIDS was decimating that community. He was certainly no saint. But that said, I came away with a grudging respect for the man. I hope readers will find that my book was eminently fair. I kept reminding myself this is his story, not my story. So I don't think there was any Catholic or liberal bias. But that the issues he raised are in many ways, perennials in American life. And he certainly changed the debate in significant ways and is someone worth learning about.
Well, on that note of grudging respect, we will conclude this podcast. Again, the book is God's Right Hand, How Jerry Falwell Made God Republican and Baptized the American Right. Thank you to Michael Sean Winters for joining us. You can read his articles and blog at ncronline.org. A special thanks to our technical director, James Garrity, and to St. Francis University's School of Arts and Letters for sponsoring this podcast. You can find the Journal of Southern Religion at jsr.fsu.edu. There you can listen to this and other podcasts, subscribe to our iTunes feed, and join us on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.